Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The National Broadcasting Company brings you the tercentenary meeting of the Harvard Alumni Association from the Sanders Academic Theater, Harvard University, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The meeting of the alumni, with the President of the United States as honored guest, marks the finale of a year of pageantry presented by Harvard in observance of her 300th anniversary of existence. All of the meetings of tercentenary celebration have been held in Harvard Yard, in the Tercentenary Theater, outdoors before an audience of some 15,000 people. But this afternoon, due to heavy rain, the meeting has been hastily moved to Sanders Theater with overflow crowds at some of the hotels in Cambridge, the new lecture hall, and in the adjoining Memorial Hall adjoining Sanders Theater. Those audiences now are awaiting the beginning of the formal program, which will be introduced by the president of the day, Dr. A. Lawrence Lowell, class of 77, president emeritus of Harvard University. The president of the United States entered Sanders Theater just a few moments ago and received an ovation from the several hundred people who have filled Sanders Theater to overflowing. He came in this morning on his presidential train, arriving here approximately 10 o'clock, and motored direct to the Tercentenary Theater in Harvard Yard. He was there this morning as an alumnus of the class of 1904 and as an honored guest. We now present Dr. Lowell, who will preside over the afternoon session.
This is an adjourned meeting. It was adjourned by some ghosts 100 years ago to meet together this day. And we should close our ceremonies by adjourning again for 100 years. Although, as Alexander said, it is sad that we shall none of us be there. After all, what is 100 years? What is 100 years? It spans the life of man. It covers all that he has to do. And then he retires and leaves the world to what he knows not. Nevertheless, every generation is the child of that which is passed away. And we look back to those ghosts that he summoned to meet us here today, to listen to what we think of, and to hear their counsel. Now, as wave after wave rolls landward from the ocean, breaks and fades away, sighing down the shingle of the beach, so the generations of men follow one another, sometimes quietly, sometimes after a storm with noisy turbulence. But whether we think upon the monotony or the violence in human history, two things are always new: youth and the quest for knowledge. And with these, a university is concerned. So long as its interest in them is keen, it can never grow old, although it counts its age by centuries. The means it uses may vary with the time, but forever the end remains the same. And while some principles based on man's nature must endure, others essential for the perhaps for the moment, are doomed to pass away. Education is as old as man, and many of the arts of life were learned and taught long before any historic record. All the domestic animals we use today were tamed no one knows how long ago. The planting of seed goes back to a past invisibly remote. So do many of the means of preserving food. And each of these advances must have been carefully taught to children, or they would have perished with their inventor. Teaching cannot be less ancient than the oldest art that was ever transmitted. And with the growth of knowledge, it has become more and more important for the public welfare. And yet we know less about it with certainty than of many other arts of later origin. The inevitable breakdown of the ancient fixed curriculum, coupled with larger openings for enjoyment on one side, and on the other, the vast expansion of knowledge, have raised up two of the pressing questions of the time we've been going through. The first has made it hard to impress upon you the value of scholarship. Apart from a definite, visible application, that value has seemed to them difficult to measure, pale as compared with athletic and social achievement. Its significance for man himself, for the development and the attitude of his mind, appears so vague. The fact that all real attainment comes by personal effort, a process of self-education under guidance, so contrary to his ideas of how teachers should labor and students absorb, that it is not easy to make him see these truths. With the problem of inciting scholarly ambition, all institutions of higher learning have been wrestling, happily by different means, for there is no single formula for achieving it, and all experiments, if judged by their results, are good. The vast increase of knowledge has raised obstacles of a different kind for the professors and for all others bent on contributing to learning. The first result was a division of the field of thought into self-contained sections under separate departments. But that has proved effective because there are no natural barriers to knowledge. It has overflowed and undermined the fences, rushing as a flood across them. And hence the later effort has been to bring the various laboratories, the whole contents of the library, and the professors themselves into as close contact as possible, so that every man may draw whatever he needs from the vast supply. A university is indeed a thing that moves and grows. In deepest gratitude to its progenitors, we recall on this occasion that 300 years ago, Harvard College was born. A brave babe with only one teacher, the president himself, who at first gave all the instruction and possessed all the learning it contained. Now it is one of the great universities of the world, one of the reservoirs and springs of knowledge that, beginning in the Middle Ages, have developed into what we see today. The vast learning stored on the shelves of the library and in the minds of the scholars in a great university, no single man can compass. of the channels leading to new knowledge, no one can explore but a small part. The treasures are well nigh inexhaustible. The opportunities limitless. And open not to members of the institution alone, but almost for the asking to anyone who has the desire and the capacity to use them. From our forebears, who in less propitious times have thought and labored and hoped here, we have inherited a priceless trust, which will be fostered until, as the Arabs say, the stars grow old, and the sun grows cold, and the leaves of the judgment book unfold. The generation that has now retired, hoping that in their own time they have made their contribution, have passed a torch that burns here to you, President Conan, and your colleagues to take farther and higher on the way.
Dr. Lowell has just presented the present president of Harvard, Dr. James Bryant Conan.
Mr. President, President Roosevelt, Governor Curley, distinguished guests, members of the Alumni Association, ladies and gentlemen. When this association of the alumni meets in Cambridge, the president of Harvard is called to account and expected to report on the present state of the university, even on a rainy day. This afternoon, none of us is interested in the present. Our eyes are on the future as we begin the fourth century of Harvard's history. My report, therefore, will be extremely brief, for it is a bold man indeed who believes that he can see far into the future. But though the visibility be poor, the course must be laid. The watch must be set. The fires must be kept roaring under the boiler. Above all, the faith of all hands in the purposes of the expedition must never falter. Now, surely this celebration we are concluding must have heartened all friends of higher education. In spite of the inclement weather, gathering this afternoon of the alumni who have returned, as it were, on a pilgrimage of devotion must stand through the years as a radiant memory. To those of us who now labor to carry forward the work, the thought of the meeting this morning of 8,000 alumni will be forever an inspiring challenge. For the immediate future, you all know our plans. They have been explained fully to the alumni during the past year. We are endeavoring to unify the many separate parts of this great university, to unify them by the most potent of bonds, the appointment of men whose personalities, interests, and learning are such as to make them natural connecting links between different academic disciplines. There are such men in the university today, but they are often hampered in their work. There are others who have been reluctant to enter a university because they did not feel that such institutions were organized to offer them a position of sufficient scope to meet their needs. We shall endeavor, through the establishment of a number of new university professorships, to provide for such men opportunities to follow their interests into whatever quarter they may lead, and to teach and to pursue research without consideration of departmental boundaries. We are developing a system of Harvard National Scholarship so that this institution, through the college and all the graduate schools, may offer further opportunities for the promising youth with little or no financial backing. The novel feature of these scholarships is the fact that they supply a stipend large enough, if necessary, to provide for the really poor boy of ability, the boy who without such a full maintenance scholarship would neither come to Harvard nor go to any other university. The stipend is adjusted to need, and in competing for the honor of holding the scholarship, rich and poor are on an equal footing. To supply the sinews of war for these plans for the future, the governing board established a 300th anniversary fund. The income from this fund to be mobile, fluid money, to be used in any part of the university for scholarships or university professorships or non-departmental teaching and research. An alumni committee was formed and has most loyally served the university by explaining the purposes of this fund to the graduates. There has been no intensive campaign, no drive for a fixed goal, but rather an opportunity provided for all the alumni who so desired to contribute at this time to the undertaking. Mr. Gardner, the chairman of the committee, has, I believe, a report to make this time on behalf of the committee.
Mr. President, as chairman of the 300th Anniversary Fund Committee, I now have the honor to present to you our report. In it are recorded the names of all subscribers and the amount subscribed to date. However, it cannot record the loyalty, friendship, and desire to serve the university which each subscription signifies.
The record which Mr. Gardner has handed to me reports that the number of alumni and friends of the university who have already contributed to the 300th Anniversary Fund, directly or through the Harvard Fund, is 8,881. And that they have subscribed as follows: $775,954 without restriction. $523,696 specifically for the support of university professorship. $1,022,685 specifically for the endowment of Harvard National Scholarship. $492,636 specifically for the encouragement of work in the physical sciences. These subscriptions added together make a total of $2,814,972. In addition, there are three important gifts that have been made in connection with or in recognition of the tercentenary. First, there is the gift of Mr. Lucius Ann Litauer, already announced but not yet formally reported, of $2 million for the support of instruction and research in public administration. Second, I have been advised by the Carnegie Corporation of New York that in recognition of the tercentenary and in the interest of dental research and dental education, it will shortly contribute to the Harvard Dental School a gift of $350,000. Further support of the Dental School Endowment made in connection with the celebration is to date $65,195. Third, a gift of $250,000 has just been received from Mrs. Frances Schlesner Lee to establish the George Burgess McGrath Endowment for Legal Medicine. In making this gift, Mrs. Lee said that although long contemplated, was made at this particular time in recognition of the 300th anniversary of the founding of Harvard College. Finally, there have been miscellaneous gifts in connection with the celebration to the amount of $8,025. The sum of all these generous benefactions and gifts made to the 300th Anniversary Fund or in recognition of the tercentenary thus amounts to a grand total of $5,488,192. It would take too long to read to you the names of the individual contributors. A list will be published shortly. But today, I wish to express the gratification which we all feel. When it was announced that the governing boards had approved plans to strengthen the life of the university as a whole and to increase the national scope of its usefulness by means of a 300th anniversary fund, hope was expressed that it would be possible at the time of this celebration to announce a substantial beginning. The generous gifts of which I have just made a summary report constitute an encouraging and auspicious beginning. Indeed, we are now in a position to appoint several university professorships and to award a substantial number of national scholarships. The first step forward in our new enterprise has been made possible by numerous small gifts as well as by a few large ones. The subscriptions flowed in during a period of depression, a period of uncertainty, of perplexity, and of doubt. The letters which have accompanied the smaller gifts, no less than the great ones, demonstrate the loyalty of Harvard's graduates. They are tokens of the gratitude of the alumni for this university's service and examples of respect for her traditions and faith in her plans for the future. For all this, the university is grateful, and on behalf of the governing board and the faculty, I wish to express the deepest appreciation. Mr. Gardner, may I take this occasion to thank you once again for what you have done and to ask you to transmit to all members of your committee and to the Harvard Fund Council our sincerest gratitude for their labor.
Gulf from the year 1836 will please take notice that in certain material aspects we are better off than they were. What will happen in the year 2036? We do not know. But we expect, of course, that the benefactions, at least, will cube every 50 years. And at the end of that time, we think that our successors ought to feel fairly comfortable. A university, I'm addressing, of course, the alumni, as you know. A university is one of the things that never had enough. If the Jewish prophet had put in those things that were never satisfied, he would have put in a university. Because the possibility of extremely valuable, may I say absolutely essential use of money in every possible direction, is one of those things to which there is absolutely no limit and never will be. when I remember the way people used to say to me, we have at Harvard no course on the antennae of the Paleozoic cockroach, and they have three of such an institution. No man must ever claim any question. But, after all, I don't know, standing here and thinking back 100 years of those ancestors of ours, I knew a good many of them. I know what earnest men they were. I know what good men. And then looking forward to 100 years hence and thinking of those men that are going to succeed us. And the same thing is true everywhere. I say to myself, how little do I care what the people of the present day think about us or about anything else. What I want to know is what posterity is going to say about it. Just as I feel today that the thing that would make the men of 100 years ago happy would be to know what is thought of Harvard today. And what we crave is to know what will be thought of us 100 years from now. Now, of course, as Eugene Coventry says, the nearest thing to posterity that you can attain at the present time is the opinion of those people at a distance. And therefore, we are extremely gratified to those of you who have crossed the ocean and crossed long ranges of land to come and congratulate us on our 300th birthday. And more than that, we are glad because you do come from a place where you can look at us, not as we look at ourselves, but as something that is more remote and farther off. Oh, yes. We all want to know what posterity will think of us. That is what we ask ourselves. Are we building with something solid? Are we building with something that will endure? Or are we building things that will shortly pass away? There is no institution in the world of which we can be more sure than we can of universities. Universities have thrived from the Middle Ages all through all the distractions that have existed. The University of Paris has seen the Fronde, has seen the French Revolution, has seen all the changes that have occurred, and it is stronger today than it ever was before. The University of Oxford has seen all the changes of the Wars of the Roses, the changes, the terrible fights of the 17th century, and it has come out stronger than it ever was before. And why? Because the university is thought to me a real thing as it comes upon the world. Now, as we want to hear from elsewhere, we are very fortunate now in being able to do so, not only from you who have come here, but from one who has not come here and who still remains up on the other side. And that is the Right Honorable Sidney Baldwin in his capacity as Chancellor of the University of Cambridge. He is to speak to us in a moment. And he will be with us here speaking from England. Let us listen.
As Chancellor of the University of Cambridge, it is with special pride that I send greetings to Harvard University on the occasion of its tercentenary. For Cambridge men, from the beginning, identified themselves with Harvard. and graduates from Trinity, Emmanuel, and King's governing body 300 years ago. Above all, it was an Emmanuel man, John Harvard, who supplied the funds for the outward and visible sign of the new college and his admirably chosen library for its inward and spiritual grace. Nor can I forget that it was a graduate of Harvard, his father and grandfather were Cambridge men, who gave his name to Downing Street, in which I live. May God's providence, which has watched over Harvard since his first home, had to be fenced in to keep out the wolves, continue to bless it. Adorned as it now is with magnificent buildings and celebrated throughout the world as a great center of learning. May Harvard men be faithful to the great traditions of liberty, which are the common glory and heritage of all the English-speaking peoples of the world. And may we all, as university men, though we cannot hope for the special fame that is John Harvard's, aspire to be remembered in our time in the simple and moving words applied to him by a contemporary. The man was a scholar and pious in his life and enlarged toward the country and the good of it in life and death.
We now return you to America.
Back in America, having heard the message of Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, Chancellor of the University of Cambridge, we now reintroduce Dr. A. Lawrence Lowell, President Emeritus of Harvard University. Dr. Lowell.
Right Honorable Stanley Baldwin, Chancellor of the University of Cambridge, if a university can have one mother, Cambridge is our mother. For Harvard was founded by her graduates 6 years after landing on these shores. Our forefathers set up a college and named the town after the place where they were trained. The University of Cambridge fostered our early days by granting to our degrees equality with her own. From her, we have drawn inspiration and example, not least in these later times. To her sons, we owe a vast debt in science and in letters. In the light she has shed, we have rejoiced. If she is the mother of Harvard, she is, through Harvard, the ancestress of most of the universities and colleges throughout the United States. It is right that we should turn to her in gratitude this day, and now when we have prospered, should seek her approbation. Therefore, in behalf of the thousands of Harvard graduates assembled about the university today, I thank you for the kind words you have said in bringing to us on this, our 300th birthday, the greeting of our parent university. Now, led by the Tercentenary Chorus, we will now all sing the 78th Psalm, which you will find printed on the second leaf of the program.
Thank you.
We are met here this afternoon, nominally at least, as alumni of Harvard. And it is fitting that we should hear first on their behalf from the distinguished president of their association, Judge Learned Hand of the United States Circuit Court, New York.
Our guests, my fellow alumni, if one of the founders of this college were to appear here today, it is doubtful whether he would not regret his endeavor and wish that his work had long since passed into chaos and black night. True, much would fascinate and bewitch him. The variety of the searches into so many fields, the ingenuity with which nature had been trapped to reveal her secrets, the imagination and patience of the search, the commonwealth of scholars who open their discoveries to all, that there may be no monopoly of learning. He would be astounded at command over the earth and its resources, which such studies as I here pursue had given to mankind. He would think it magic that men had learned to transport themselves so swiftly, to talk and to write and to see instantaneously at any distance, by an alchemy of which he had only dreamed, to transmute substances, to divine the location of metals and of hidden sources of energy. Looking more widely, he would be amazed at the cleanliness of the city, at the certainty with which a continuous supply of food was provided, at the hospitals open to all, where the body is painlessly relieved of many of its torments and its ailments are subtly unraveled and often cured. He would be delighted at the way by which the knowledge of the past could be deciphered from broken stone, potsherd, and ruined wall. He would feel the sweep of his antiquity and the drama of his history when he found how bit by bit its mosaic was being sagaciously filled out. All this and much more he would feel, and it would exhilarate him and make him thankful that he had had any part in a venture which could so contribute to man's freedom and enlightenment, to his command over his fate, to his independence of chance. But when the first shock was passed, and after he had become habituated to the pageant of these wonders, another feeling would succeed if he had been a true child of his own time. He would remember the purpose with which he and his fellows had founded this pious testimonial to their faith. It was to inculcate a knowledge of God and of his ways, of man's duty and of his dependence. All this he would find absent. It would seem to him as though a rich table had been spread, and youth were invited to choose from it at random, as though there were no direction, nothing to guide it to an understanding of its duties, its interests, or its fate. Worse than that, there would appear to be a personal, though implicit, assumption that neither duties, interests, nor fate could in fact be comprehended, for everywhere he would infer that the knowledge of truth, if not truth itself, was assumed to be an accidental acquisition, depending on how far happy intuition might turn out to be verified by experiment, so far as experiment could be so conducted as to be a valid test, which was not often the case. For the rest, youth was left to its own devices because nobody had a substitute that he would guarantee or indeed even venture to put forward. Our founder, seeing his college, which he had hoped would help towards the understanding of divine truth, thus reduced it to a Tower of Babel, might well wish that he had spared his fame and even regret that he'd been called back at all for a glimpse of their profanation. I remember when I was at this college many years ago, hearing a lecture by President Eliot about the early teaching of Louis Agassiz. He said that Agassiz used to give each pupil a piece of stone and tell him to examine it and report to him what he found. One boy came back in a few hours, ready to answer. "Not yet," said Agassiz. "Come back in a fortnight." The boy told his father, who was much disgusted. "That is absurd," he said. "That is the way a puppy learns." "Yes, gentlemen," said to us that serene, majestic presence. I can hear it as though he were here today. "Yes, gentlemen, that is the way a puppy learns. And that is the way each one of us must learn." Probably you will agree. In that symbol we have conquered, and it has become our gospel. Truth can be ascertained only through trial and error. No education is worthy of the name that does not acquaint the student, in however small a field, with that method at first hand. Only so can he escape from leading strings. Yet in another sense, the boy's father was right. So far as we can tell, the native powers of mankind have not improved for thousands of years. Our remote ancestors were as good as we. If a child today knows more than Aristotle, it is only because he is the inheritor of a mass of acquired and ordered experience. Life is too short, an experiment too costly for the individual to verify an appreciable part of what the race has learned. He must be content to depend upon authority and can hope for no larger contribution of his own than to establish the hallmark by which to divide the false prophet from the true. Empiricists in theory, we may boast ourselves, bound to accept nothing that will not withstand every test. Practically, we are condemned to be authoritarian and must guide our lives by the authentic deliverances of accredited sages. That would not be so bad if the inward universe of will and feeling remained our own. And so indeed, at first it seems to do. We love, we desire, we welcome, we reject. All is the spirit listed. There is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Our choices are underized. As to them, we recognize no authority. Nor need it concern us, though their origin be in our bodies and their occurrence be dependent upon the outside world. It is enough if we are unaware of the impact of influences felt, not felt, to the alien and coercive. Freedom we need not distinguish, trouble to distinguish from the consciousness of freedom. Here at last, we can be ourselves. If man were an ephemera living for an hour, he might reason so. Each choice would then be without significance beyond itself, without implication or consequence, the absolute self-affirmation of a god. But he lives in time, and amid his kind, he looks before and after, his days are bound each to each, and he has his being only as a member of a group. That continuity and that communal nature clip his wings and cage his flight, not only to predict the future consequences of his conduct, but to appraise him in advance. After he has done so, he must resort to the experience of others. It is true that when I choose between present goods, between pushpin and poetry, so to say, I am dealing directly with absolute data, the irreducible atoms of the moral universe. Incommensurable they may be, but I measure them. My choice is the deepest manifestation of my being. No mediation is necessary, and nothing more is to be said. But when I choose between my present and my future good, or between my own welfare and another, I am conscious of no such self-sufficiency. Be my will as pure as a saint's, how am I to weigh your advantage against my own? I can have no intuitive warrant for knowing that what is good for you is good for me, is good for you, For how is my own ghostly future to take on a body that I can match against the poignant demands of the moment? Perhaps I shall exact an undue discount of the absent good, or perhaps I shall overvalue it. But in any event, I must have recourse to some arbiter outside my immediate self, which can make these phantoms real. I must recognize an authority just as though I were dealing with the outside world. In fact, that is what I am dealing with. And so the wise have taught since the first syllable of recorded time. An individual must not be left to his own moral devices. Somewhere, somehow, he must be able to find a rule, a plan, a course, a map to show him the path of his salvation. Our founder, then, seems to have been justified. There must be oracles to which youth may repair and whose message we may and should inculcate. We cannot leave it to the bias of the immediate. Liberty is an illusion, useful only when antiquated authority is to be overthrown, but is itself a signal for chaos and a symptom of decay. Is there no answer? Perhaps not, not at least over the whole of that vast future which lies before us. Conceivably, the time may come when the heart shall be so understood and men shall have become so benign that there will be a gentle rule which each will feel to be his own, when there will be not even a willful handful to rebel against standards in perfect conformity with a common human nature. We have no glimmering of the infinite varieties of those patterns which the future has in store. Besides, what is it we wish to preserve? Is it disregard of the wisdom of the ages? Is it insensibility to the welfare of our fellows? Is it yielding to the moment's impulse against the counsels of prudence? What is this freedom which escapes all bounds and would set its face against an ordered universe? The less of it, the better. And yet, when all is said, when the counsels of prudence and the admonitions of virtue have been heeded, when the future has been discounted and the claims of others have been measured, though reason chased, there comes a voice without reply deep from the recesses of our being. Inarticulate, primitive, animal perhaps, but imperious, not to be denied. The core of life remains untouched, the kernel from which the rest has come. Absolute, unbound, knowing no loyalties but a single loyalty, admitting no coercion, its very essence in its affirmation, the self asserts its unassailable right to create all value. What it chooses alone is good. Others may command, it may be forced to comply, but within, its rule is unimpaired. It knows no compromise, it brooks no equal. That is the unbending spirit we would foster. That is the freedom we wish to ensure. These would be mad, whirling words to our founder, justifying his worst fears. The insolent defiance by a puny creature of his maker, through whose grace alone he might hope to escape damnation. Perhaps he would be right, but even on his own premises that is not too clear. For why did that doctrine on which he set his faith spread over the world? Was it not just because it whispered in the weary ears of the downtrodden that each life is sacred, that each faith is momentous? A sparrow cannot fall without God's will. Can that be sacred which another bids? Can that be momentous which is derived? The command alone can be sacred. The original alone can be momentous. Implicit was the belief that man and man alone creates the universe of good and evil, that beyond and beneath all commandments is the commandment, be thyself. 300 years hence, men may once again gather here on a mission like ours. We cannot foreshadow their faith, their hope, their compromises, their loyalty. Could we return, these would seem to us strange and perverse, as ours will seem to them, drawn out of limbo as they will be for the curious. Complaisance may be the order of that day. All may freely acknowledge the mild rule of all. Nature then will know that harmony alone could hold all heaven and earth in happier union. And heaven, as at some festival, will open wide the gates of her high palace hall. We shall appear thin and childish, defiant out of fear for our petty selves, which stood in need only of enlightenment. So be it. Life is a dicer's throw, and reason a smoky toss. We move by what light we have, but some light we need to move at all. This then be ours. With it, we will grope our way. A long procession of future generations will weigh our faith, and we shall never know the verdict. Nor need we care.
Yonder, our Oriflamme unfurls.
The National Broadcasting Company is bringing you the tercentenary meeting of the Harvard Alumni Association from Sanders Academic Theater at Harvard University. Now, Dr. Lowell, once more.
The next speaker, it would be impertinent for me to attempt to introduce to you or to any audience. He is the fourth graduate of Harvard College to hold the office of Street Chief Magistrate in our nation. Two of them were named Adams and two Roosevelt. Gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Distinguished guests, my fellow alumni, I am here today in a joint and several capacity. First, as President of the United States. Second, as Chairman of the United States Harvard Tercentenary Commission, which is composed of five members of the Senate, five of the House of Representatives, a representative of the United States Army and one of the Navy, and two representing universities of the United States, the distinguished presidents of the University of California and the University of North Carolina. And finally, I am here as a son of Harvard who gladly returns to this spot where men have sought truth for 300 years. Our roots are deep in the past, and it is pleasant to remember today that this meeting is being held in pursuance of an adjournment expressly taken 100 years ago on motion of Josiah Quincy. At that time, many of the alumni of Harvard were sorely troubled concerning the state of the nation. Andrew Jackson was president. On the 200... On the 250th anniversary of the founding of Harvard College, alumni again were sorely troubled. Grover Cleveland was president. And now, on the 300th anniversary, I am president. Back a little further, in the words of Euripides, there be many shapes of mystery and many things God makes to be, past hope or fear, and the end men look for cometh not, and a path is there where no man sought, so hath it fallen here. And in spite of fears, Harvard and the nation of which it is a part have marched steadily to new and successful achievements, changing their formations and their strategy to meet new conditions, but marching always under the old banner of freedom. In the older days of New England, it was Increase Mather who told the students of Harvard that they were pledged to the word of no particular master, that they should above all find a friend in truth. And that became the creed of Harvard. Behind the tumult and the shouting, it is still the creed of Harvard. In this day of modern witch burning, when freedom of thought has been exiled from many lands which were once its home, it is the part of Harvard and America to stand for the freedom of the human mind and to carry the torch of truth. For centuries, the grand old saying, "The truth is great and will prevail," has been a rock of support for persecuted men. But it depends on man's tolerance, self-restraint, and devotion to freedom, not only for themselves, but also for others, whether the truth will prevail through free research, free discussion, and the free intercourse of civilized men, or will prevail only after suppression and suffering, when none cares whether it prevails or not. Love of liberty and freedom of thought is a most admirable attribute of Harvard. But it is not an exclusive possession of Harvard, nor of any other university in America or anywhere else. Love of liberty and freedom of thought are as profound in the homes and on the farms and in the factories of this country as in any university. Liberty is the air that we Americans breathe. Our government is based on the belief that a people can be both strong and free, that civilized men need no restraint, but that imposed by themselves against abuse of freedom. Nevertheless, it is the peculiar task of Harvard and of every other university and college in this country to foster and maintain not only freedom within its own walls, but also tolerance, self-restraint, fair dealing, and devotion to the truth throughout America. Many students who have come to Harvard in the past have left it with inquiring and open minds, ready to render service to the nation. They have been given much, and from them much has been expected. They have rendered great service. It is, I am confident, of the inner essence of Harvard that its sons have fully participated in each great drama of our nation's history. They have met the challenge of the event. They have seen in the challenge opportunity to fulfill the end the university exists to serve. As the chief executive of the nation, I bring to you the solicitation of our people. In the name of the American nation, I venture to ask you to cherish its traditions and to fulfill its highest opportunities. We need in the days to come, as we needed in the past, from Harvard, men like Charles William Eliot, William James, and Mr. Justice Holmes, who made their minds swords in the service of American freedom. They served America with courage, wisdom, human understanding. They were without hatred, malice, or selfishness. They were civilized gentlemen. The past of Harvard has been deeply distinguished. This university will never fail to produce its due proportion of those judged successful by the common standards of success. Of such the world has need. But to produce that type is not the ultimate justification that you would make for Harvard. Rather do we here search for the atmosphere in which men are produced to have either the rare quality of vision or the ability to appreciate the significance of vision when it appears. Where there is vision, there is tolerance, and where there is tolerance, there is peace. And I beg you to think of tolerance and peace not as indifferent and neutral virtues, but as active and positive principles. I am not, you will observe, conceiving of the university as a mere spectator of the great national and international drama in which all of us, despite ourselves, are involved. Here are to be trained not lawyers and doctors merely, not teachers and businessmen and scientists merely. Here is to be trained in the fullest sense man. Harvard should train men, men to be citizens in that high Athenian sense which compels a man to live his life unceasingly, aware that its civic significance is its most abiding, and that the rich individual diversity of the truly civilized state is born only of the wisdom to choose ways to achieve, ways that do not hurt one's neighbors. And I am asking the sons of Harvard to dedicate themselves not only to the perpetuation, but also to the enlargement of that spirit. To pay ardent reverence to the past, but to recognize no less the direction of the future, to understand philosophies we do not accept and hopes we find it difficult to share, to account the service of mankind the highest ambition a man can follow, and to know that there is no calling so humble that it cannot be instinct with that ambition. Never to be indifferent to what may affect our neighbors. Always as Coleridge said, to put truth in the first place and not in the second. These, I would affirm, are the qualities by which the real is distinguished from the nominal scholar. It is only when we have attained this philosophy that we can, above all, find a friend in truth. When America is dedicated to that end by the common will of all her citizens, then America can accomplish her highest ideals. To the measure that Harvard participates in that dedication, Harvard will be justified of her effort, her purpose, and her success in the fourth century of her life.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States, an alumnus of Harvard University, class of 1904, speaking today at the tercentenary meeting of the Harvard Alumni Association. The President now is making his way to the rear of the platform. He's going to leave immediately to board his special train for his return trip to Washington. And now for the balance of this broadcast, I'm pleased to introduce the official NBC tercentenary announcer, Howard Klaney.
Thank you, Carlton Smith. President Lowell is once again on the platform.
We'll now sing The Shores of Harvard, written by Mark Antony DeWolf Powell.
The Centenary Chorus has just sung The Shores of Harvard by Holst.
On this occasion, we crave the greeting of our American colleagues. And no one can bring them more appropriately than President Angel, with his great experience as an undergraduate at the University of Michigan, as a teacher and dean at the University of Chicago, and now as the head of Yale. Our next of kin, our younger sister, over 200 years old, it is true, but with more youthful vigor than ever, and with a limitless future before us, President Hayes.
Gentlemen of the Harvard alumni, despite my possession of two Harvard degrees, it is with considerable astonishment that I regard my own audacity in appearing here, a Vermont Yankee, representing Connecticut orthodoxy in partibus infidelium. I pay my tribute at once to the shrewd, adroit Yankee arrangements by which Harvard has managed to have her 300th anniversary coincide with the occasional appearance of one of her sons in the Chief Magistracy of the United States. Whatever may be her misunderstanding with the powers that control the weather, there can be no question of her grip upon those political and social influences which lead to the most important episodes in life. It is with peculiar pride and gratification that Harvard's eldest daughter, her nearest of kin, attends this festal occasion to join with all the learned world in singing her praises and in wishing her yet many centuries of invaluable service to mankind. One cannot possibly add to the chorus of praise, couched in felicitous praise, with which these halls have been ringing the last few days. Founded and in her early years largely guided by men of Harvard lineage, Yale has always felt herself bound by ties of special intimacy to the parent institution, a circumstance which has not prevented her from cherishing at times toward Harvard sentiments of more than doubtful moral elevation. Sentiments familiar, if not approved, in all family circles, and almost always warmly reciprocated by Harvard. It is not without reason that each speaks of the other as its dearest enemy. But today, Yale comes bearing only the olive branch and a garland of bay leaves. And if I may interrupt my own eloquence, to pay a brief tribute to a group of Harvard men who have meant much in my own life, I would recall my presence here in the early 90s, sitting at the feet of William James and Josiah Royce and George Palmer and the group of men who were here at Harvard at that time, who left an indelible impress on my mind, and together with John Dewey, then of Michigan, formed for me the general outlines of the Weltanschauung, which I have carried all through my life since, and for which I owe a debt of gratitude that I cannot hope to pay. To President Charles W. Eliot, I have also the warmest memories, for he offered me my first academic job. And believe me, at the time when that happened, it was a matter of some consequence to me whether I had a job or not. It has sometime since been true. And when I became president of Yale, I found Lawrence Lowell here at Harvard extending to me the warmest friendship and help, always willing to counsel and guide, which repeatedly he did. And as long as he served, no shadow, I think, ever arose between the relations, over the relations of Harvard and Yale, which he and I were not able quickly to banish when we came together and talked the thing out. And now his great successor, whose noble address so stirred us this morning, has come into my group of dear and appreciated friends, a man so much younger than I that I hesitate to classify him at all in my generation, and yet a man for whom I've already conceived the most profound admiration. I was told as we left the deluge this morning by a Harvard graduate that that was President Conant's method of soaking the rich. Of course, have no objection to that if they are Harvard rich. But I thought it was a little rough on the country cousins. No one can view the history of universities without being profoundly impressed, as President Lowell a moment ago reminded us, by their amazing vitality and longevity. Nations come and go, dynasties rise and fall, civilization itself is radically transformed, but the great universities live on. Clearly they minister to enduring needs which men will not allow to go unsatisfied. And Harvard, for all her relative youth, on the roster of the world's great seats of learning, and even in the Western world, three exceed her in age, Harvard has abundantly exemplified some of the noblest of the traits to which the university as an institution owes its preservation. Familiar as they are, we can hardly too often remind ourselves of them, nor too firmly fix our resolution upon their protection. With unflinching courage, Harvard has steadfastly fought for complete intellectual liberty. The struggle has been sometimes with religious bigotry, sometimes with political usurpation, sometimes with social prejudice, and each of these forces can exercise tremendous pressure upon institutions dependent for their existence on public approval. But despite occasional setbacks, she has always ultimately won through, so that freedom of thought and speech within her halls has ever been safeguarded for scholars. Again, she has been Catholic in cultivating constantly widening ranges of intellectual interests, Starting as a curate in college with half a dozen subjects of study, she has steadily broadened her reach until there is now no appreciable territory in the empire of the mind which is alien to her. This achievement has often required something of the daring of the pioneer, a willingness to venture exploration and conquest in new lands whose value no one could confidently predict. It has always meant defiance of the smug conservative, wedded to the idols of the past. But all of these accomplishments would have been shadowed by mediocrity had she not so resolutely sought for her faculties, men of the very highest intellectual caliber. It is at this point, after all, that the truly matchless values of a university are to be found, values which can only be fully exploited by the choicest youth of each generation. Incident to the execution of her ends, she has assembled one of the world's most magnificent libraries, where are preserved the imperishable treasures of the human spirit throughout the ages, and has supplied to her scholars all the technical facilities which superb laboratories and exhaustive collections afford. For all these achievements, and many more that must go here unnumbered, the world owes Harvard a lasting debt of gratitude, and especially are the colleges and the universities of America, and whosoever loves learning and books, debtor to her. In the somewhat fatuous and futile comparisons of institutions with one another, so dear to the heart of certain rather literal and metallic-minded folk, she is often put first, and judged by many criteria, she doubtless deserves such a rating. But her essential human significance is not thus to be measured. Rather does it reside in those sterling qualities which are indigenous to her, reflected again and again in her history. Vision and imagination tempered by wisdom, high moral courage and candor, unswerving allegiance to intellectual liberty, with unquestioning reliance upon integrity of thought, unshakable belief in the ultimate worth of sheer intelligence and the incomparable value of the great mind. These are some of the most obvious qualities which have brought her undying fame and won for her 3 centuries of noble history in which every patriotic citizen must take pride. Would that we could turn away from this festival of felicitation with no feeling but one of joy in a great achievement and placid confidence in what the future holds in store for Harvard and for all other universities. But to do so would argue us completely oblivious to certain of the most tragic happenings of our time. I have no appetite for playing the part of Banquo's ghost, but there is another picture of the learned world, unhappily all too true, which ought not wholly to escape us, and for a brief mention of which I beg your indulgence. In 3 of the great nations of the world, the university is the home of intellectual freedom, of truth for truth's sake, is essentially extinct. Some of the most revered seats of learning have overnight been transformed into propaganda factories. How much further the process may go, no one can foresee, much less predict. But almost in the twinkling of an eye, one great set of values for which generations of men had struggled and sacrificed, and to which men paid the tribute of deep and sincere reverence, have been wiped out. It never can happen here, say the self-complacent, and let us hope that they speak truly. But already there are current among us movements hardly less ruinous, if they go unchecked, than those which on the continent have despoiled ancient universities of their most precious birthright. Perhaps most often in our own educational history, it has been the attack of sectarian bigotry which our colleges have had to resist. Harvard history reveals not a few such episodes. I wish I could wholly share President Conant's confidence that this danger has passed. But if one recalls the number of states in which by law and under sectarian influence, one may not preach the doctrine of evolution or expound the doctrine of evolution, even if you do not preach it, without encountering the penalty of the law, if one recalls organizations like the Ku Klux, it at least gives one to think. But today, the most menacing attack comes, as it has repeatedly in the past, from the political side. In one form, it is precipitated by allegedly patriotic organizations committed to maintain in schools and colleges their own particular conception of loyalty. The motives of these misguided folk are, I doubt not, often excellent. But they have opened the cover of Pandora's box, and we may well be fearful of the issue. For example, in many schools, American history may now be taught only in terms these self-appointed patriots deem desirable. Teachers who will not prostitute their knowledge and convictions to the often ignorant bias of these worthies must find other jobs. Sometimes the results desired are sought through the imposition of teachers' oaths, sometimes by more direct methods. But the outcome is always the same, to wit, the assignment to busybodies, often moronic in mentality, of the power to terrorize able and honest teachers with the ultimate ruin of the morale of the teaching force.
You have just heard the broadcast address of Dr. James Roland Angel, President of Yale University. This is part of the special series of programs being presented by the National Broadcasting Company in connection with the Harvard Tercentenary Celebration. Today's meeting is the meeting of the Harvard Alumni Association. On this program, we had the pleasure of listening to Dr. A. Lawrence Lowell, Class of 77, President of Harvard University Emeritus, and President of the Day. The present president of the university, Dr. James Bryant Conant, of the class of 14, then addressed the audience, and this was followed by a message from the University of Cambridge, brought to us by shortwave radio from England, and on this we heard the voice of Mr. Stanley Baldwin. Mr. Leonard Hand, of the class of 1893, president of the Alumni Association, then presented his address, and was followed by the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, of the class of 1904, Harvard University. The college song, The Shores of Harvard, was then presented by the Tercentenary Chorus, and this was followed by the address which you have just heard, that of Dr. James Roland Angel, President of Yale University. I hold before me at this time in my hand the pictures of the Presidents of the United States who have attended this college. The first picture I have is that of our speaker of the day, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt of the class of 1904. The next picture is that of John Adams, 1755. Then John Quincy Adams, 1787. Rutherford B. Hayes, 1854. And Theodore Roosevelt, 1880. This concludes our program for today. Your announcers have been Carlton Smith and Howard Claney. This is a Blue Network presentation of the National Broadcasting Company.